I Believe by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 6. Algernon shuddered violently in his sleep. Algernon? 53? Whoever it was now, he shuddered violently in his sleep. No, it was not sleep. It was the most terrible nightmare he'd ever had in his life experienced. He thought of an earthquake which had happened near Messina, Salonika, where buildings had toppled and where the earth had yawned and people had fallen through to be squashed flat as the earth, yawning, closed again. This was terrible, terrible. This was the worst thing he could ever experience, the worst thing he could ever imagine. He felt that he was being mashed and squashed. For a time, in his confused nightmare state, he imagined that he'd been caught up by a boa constrictor in the Congo and was being forced willy-nilly down the snake's throat. All the world seemed to be upside down. Everything seemed to be shaking. There was pain, convulsions. He felt pulverized, terrified. From a distance away there came a muffled scream, a scream as heard through water and thick swadding. Barely conscious in his pain, he made out, "Martin! Martin! Get a taxi quickly! It's started!" He mulled over the name. Martin. Martin. He had a vague, but only a very vague, recollection that at some time, somewhere, in some life, he'd heard that name before, but no, try as he would, he could not bring back into his memory's recall what the name meant or to whom it was applied. Conditions were just terrible. The squeezing went on. There was the horrid gurgling of fluids. For a moment he thought he'd fallen into a sewer. The temperature increased. It was truly a shocking experience. Suddenly, violently, he was upended and he was conscious of terrible pain in the back of his neck. There was a peculiar sensation of motion, nothing that he had ever experienced before. He felt suffocated and stifled, and he felt as though immersed in fluid. "But that can't be, can it?" he thought. "Men can't live in fluid, not since we emerged from the sea, anyhow." The joggling and jolting continued for some time, and then at last there came a jolt, and a very muffled, bubbly voice snarled, "Careful, man, careful. Do you want her to have it here in the taxi?" There was some sort of mumble in reply, but it was all dreadfully muffled. Algernon was nearly out of his mind with confusion. None of this made any sense to him. He just did not know where he was, did not know what was happening. Things had been quite fantastically terrible of late, and it was no longer possible to act as a rational being. Dim memories floated into his consciousness. Something about a knife somewhere, or was it a razor? That had been a terrible dream. He had dreamed that he had half hacked off his head, and then he had looked at himself while he was hanging halfway through the ceiling, upside down he was, too, looking at himself lying dead on the floor. Ridiculous, completely absurd, of course, but what was this other nightmare? What was he now? He seemed to be some sort of a convict, accused of some sort of a crime. He did not know what it was at all. The poor fellow was nearly out of his mind with confusion, with distress, and with fearful apprehension of impending doom. But the juggling went on. "Careful now, careful, I say, go easy. Bear a hand behind, will you?" It was all so muffled, so unreal, and the tones were so coarse. It reminded him of a costermonger he had heard once in some back street of Bermondsey in London. But what had Bermondsey got to do with him now? Where was he? He tried to rub his head, tried to rub his eyes, but to his horror, he found there was some cable or something encircling him. Once again, he thought that he must be in the lower astral, because his movements were constricted. This was just too terrible for contemplation. He seemed to be in a pool of water. Before, it had seemed to be a sticky mess when he had been in the lower astral. Or had he been in the lower astral? Dazedly, he tried to force his reluctant, aching mind to search along the paths of memory. But no, nothing was right. Nothing would focus with clarity. "Oh, God," he thought worriedly, "I must have gone mad and be in an asylum for that condition. I must be having living nightmares. This just can't possibly happen to any person at all. How could I, a member of such an old and respected family, have come down to this? We've always been respected for our poise and our sanity. Oh, God, what has happened to me?" There was a sudden jolt, a most inexplicable occurrence. A sudden jolt, and then the pains came again. Dimly, he became aware of someone screaming. Normally, he thought it would have been a high-pitched scream, but now everything was muffled. Everything was so incredibly strange. Nothing made any sense anymore. He lay back in wherever he was and found that this time he was on his face. And then a sudden convulsion of something whirled him about, and then he was on his back again, shuddering with the whole fiber of his being, trembling in terror. "I tremble?" he asked himself in horror. "I am nearly out of my mind with fear. I am an officer and a gentleman. What is this evil thing which has befallen me? Of a verity, I must be suffering from some grave mental affliction. I fear for my future." He tried to clear his mind. He tried, with all the mental power at his command, to think what had happened. What was happening? All he got was confused, improbable sensations. Something about going before a board, something about planning what he was going to do. And then he had been resting on a table. No, it was useless. His mind recoiled at the thought, and for a moment went blank. Again, there came a violent movement. Again, he was convinced that he was in the coils of a boa constrictor, being prepared for crushing and digestion. But there was nothing he could do about it. He was in a state of utter terror. Nothing seemed to be going right. How had he got in the clutches of a boa constrictor first, and how would he be in a place where there were such creatures? It was all beyond him. A terrible screech, muffled badly by his surroundings, shook him to the core. Then there came a violent wrenching and tearing, and he thought his head was being torn from his body. Oh, my God, he thought. Then it is true. I did cut my throat, and my head is now falling away from me. Oh, my God, what shall I do? Shockingly, and with terrifying suddenness, there was a gushing of water, and he found himself deposited on something yielding. He found himself gasping and struggling. He seemed to have a warm, wet blanket over his face. Then, to his horror, he found pulsations, strong urgings were forcing him through some very narrow, cloying, clinging channel, and something, it seemed to be a cord fixed around his middle, tried to hold him back. The cord he could feel twisting around one of his feet. He kicked violently to try and free it, because here he was suffocating in humid darkness. He kicked again, and a wild screech, louder now, burst out from somewhere above and behind him. There was a further terrific convulsion and twisting, and he shot out of the darkness into a light so dazzling bright that he thought he'd been struck blind on the spot. He could see nothing, but from the very warm surroundings he had now, he was precipitated on to something rough and cold. The cold seemed to seep into his bones, and he shivered. To his amazement, he found that he was sopping wet, and then something grasped him by the ankles and whisked him up into the air, upside down. There was a sharp slap, slap across his buttocks, and he opened his mouth to protest at the indignity, at the outrage perpetrated upon the helpless body of an officer and a gentleman. With his first scream of rage, all memory of the past faded from him as a dream fades at the opening of a new day, and a baby was born. Of course, not every baby has experiences such as this, because the average baby is just an unconscious mass of protoplasm until he's born. But only when it is born does consciousness take over. But in the case of Algernon, or 53, or whatever you want to call him, the matter was somewhat different, because he'd been a suicide. Because he'd been a very difficult case indeed, and there was an extra factor. This person, this entity, had to return with a special purpose in mind. He had to take up a special vocation, and so the knowledge of what was that vocation had to be passed on from the astral world through the being-born baby, and straight on to the mental matrix of the newborn baby. For some time, the baby lay or was moved about. Things were done to the baby. Something attached to its body was cut away, but the baby was oblivious to it all. Algernon had gone. Now there was a baby with no name. But after a few days in the hospital, vague shapes came and moved in front of the baby's blurry vision. "Coo," said a somewhat crude voice. Runty little devil, ain't he? What you gonna call him, Mary? The mother, fondly gazing down at her firstborn, looked away and smiled up at the visitor and said, "Well, I think we're going to call him Alan. We decided if it was a girl, we'd call her Alice, and if it was a boy, we'd call him Alan. And so, Alan, it's going to be." After a few more days, Martin called for his wife at the hospital, and together they left, carrying the small bundle which was starting out a fresh life upon the earth, a life which none of them knew at that time was destined to end 30 years on. The baby boy was taken away to a home in what was a fairly presentable part of Wapping, well within sound of the hooting of the tugs on the Thames River, where the great ships in the Pool of London came and hooted their welcome at getting back into a port, or screamed farewell with their sirens as they left the Port of London, to go out again on a journey perhaps to the other side of the world. And in that little house, not too far from Wapping Steps, a baby boy slept in a room above the shop where later he was going to wash potatoes, toss out bad fruit, and cut away rotten leaves from cabbages. But now the baby boy had to rest, had to grow a little, and learn a different lifestyle. Time went on as time will. It has never been known to stop. And the little boy was now 4 years of age. On this warm Sunday afternoon, he was sitting on Grandpa Bond's knee, when suddenly Grandpa leaned down towards him and said, "Well, what are you going to be when you grow up, boy?" The boy mumbled to himself and carefully examined his fingers, and then he said in a childish treble, "Doctor, doctor." Having said that, he slithered off his grandfather's knee and ran shyly away. "Well, grandfather," said Mary Bond, "it's a funny thing, you know, and I don't understand it at all, but he seems dead keen on anything to do with medicine. And him, just 4 years of age. When the doctor comes, he won't let go of the doctor's, you know, that thing around his neck, that tube thing." "Stethoscope," said Grandpa. "Well, yes, that's what he said, stethoscope," quote Mary Bond. "Can't understand what it is. He seems to have got a real obsession about it. And how can he think of being a doctor with us in our position?" Time still went on. Alan Bond was now 10 years of age, and for a boy of 10 years of age he was studying quite hard at school. As the teacher said, "I don't understand about Alan, Mrs. Bond. He really does study, and it's absolutely abnormal. It's not natural for a boy to study like this. All the time he's wanting to talk about doctoring and things like that. It's a tragedy, really, because, no offense intended, Mrs. Bond, but how can he expect to be a doctor?" Mary Bond thought about it all the time. She thought about it in the long stillnesses of the night, when only the roar of traffic, to which she was immune, and the hooting of craft upon the Thames, to which she was accustomed, broke the night stillness. She thought long and hard, and then at last, in conversation with the neighbor, she had an idea come to her. The neighbor said, "Well, you know, Mary, there's a scheme out nowadays that if you get 'em young enough, you can get a child insured. You pay so many pence every week. Every week for sure you gotta pay. And then at a certain age, you decide that with your insurance man, at that certain age, a boy can get a big sum of money, which will put him through medical school. I know there's such a scheme. I know of a boy who's already done it. He's a lawyer. I'll get Bob Miller to come along and see you. He'll talk to you about it. He knows all there is to know about these insurance schemes. The neighbor rushed away, full of good intentions, full of planning another person's future for him. The years went on, and at last Alan Bond entered grammar school. The headmaster interviewed him on the first day of school. "Well, my boy, and what do you propose to be in your life when you leave school?" "I'm going to be a doctor, sir," said Alan Bond, confidently looking straight at the headmaster. "Oh, well, my boy, there's no harm in having these high aspirations, but you will have to study very hard to be a doctor, and you'll have to get many scholarships because your parents definitely can't afford to pay your way through medical school and provide all the extra expenses which are incurred. I suggest, my boy, that you try to have something as a second string, as it were, to your ambitions." "Damn you, boy," said Martin Bond. "Can't you put that blasted book down for a minute? Haven't I told you to scrub those potatoes? Mrs. Potter will take her custom elsewhere if we let her have potatoes with great gobs of soil on them. Put your book down, I say. Put it down and get busy with them there spuds. I want 'em spotless, and when they're spotless, you go and deliver them to Mrs. Potter up in the High." The father moved away in exasperation, muttering to himself, "Damn it all! Why do kids have ideas all the way beyond their station nowadays? That's all he thinks of. Thinks nothing else but being a doctor. How the devil he think I'm going to get the money to pay for him being a doctor? Still, though," he thought to himself, "he's a real whiz at school, they say, and when it comes to brains, he was in the first line when they were handing them out. Yeah, he's working hard at school studies, really trying to get a scholarship. I guess I've been a bit too hard on him. He can't study properly when he's got a book propped up in front of him and I'm making him scrub spuds. I'll go and give him a hand." Father Bond went back to where his son was sitting on a three-legged stool in front of a bath. In his left hand, the boy had a book. In his right hand, he was groping wildly to find a potato. And then he'd just drop it in the bath of water and swish it round a bit and then flip it out onto some folded newspapers. "I'll give you a hand for a bit, boy. Then we'll get these things done up and you can go off and do your studying again. I've no wish to be hard on you, boy, but I've got a living to get. There's you to keep, there's your mother to keep, and there's me as well. And we've got to pay our rent, we've got to pay our taxes, we've got all manner of things to pay. And the government, they don't care a damn about us. Come on, let's get 'em cleaned up." It was the end of the school term. The headmaster and the teachers stood upon the dais. There were members of the school board there, too, and in the great hall, children sat down, done up in their very best Sunday clothes, scrubbed, uncomfortable, and embarrassed. Beside them, fidgeting in the unaccustomed surroundings, sat parents and relatives. Here and there, a thirsty man would sneak longing eyes out the window and across at a nearby pub. But this was prize day, speech day, and all the rest of it, and they had to stay here. One man thought to himself, "Well, be jabbers. I've only got to come here once a year, the brats. They've got to come here every day." The headmaster rose to his feet and carefully adjusted the glasses upon the bridge of his nose. He cleared his throat and gazed blindly at the congregation before him. "I have much pleasure," he intoned in a most scholastic voice, "in telling you that Alan Bond has made quite phenomenal progress during this last school year. He has proved to be an absolute credit to our tutorial methods, and it gives me much pleasure to announce that he's been awarded a scholarship to the pre-medical school of St. Magot's." He stopped, waiting for the wild applause to die down, and then, raising his hand for silence, he said again, "He has been awarded this scholarship, which is the first to be so awarded to any boy in this parish. I am sure that all of us wish him the very best of success in his career, for in the 4 years he's been at this school, he has consistently and persistently asserted that he was going to be a doctor of medicine, and now he has his chance." He fumbled at the papers on the lectern before him, and a whole bunch of papers fell off, and the sheets became airborne and went fluttering over the dais. Teachers hurriedly bent down and retrieved the falling sheets, carefully sorting them and placing them again on the lectern. The headmaster riffled through some papers and then seized upon one. "Alan Bond, will you come to me to receive this diploma and the award of the scholarship which has just been confirmed?"
I dunno," said Father Bond when they got home and Alan was showing them the recommendation. "It seems to me, Alan, my boy, that you're getting ideas far above your station in life. We're just greengrocers. We don't have no doctors or lawyers in the family. Dunno why you get these wild ideas."
"But, Father," cried a despairing Alan, "I've been talking about becoming a doctor for as long as I could speak, and now all my school life I've worked, I've slaved, I've denied myself all the pleasures to study and to win scholarships, and now I've got a scholarship, and you're raising objections again?" Mary Bond, Alan's mother, sat silent. Only the way her hands could not keep still betrayed the difficulty she was having. Father and mother looked at each other, and then the father said, "Look, Alan, we're not trying to keep you back, boy. We're not trying to harm your chances. But here you got a piece of paper. And, well, what's that paper mean? It just means that you can go to a certain school, and your schooling will be free. But how about all the other stuff? How about all the books, all the instruments, and all the rest of it?" He looked helplessly at his son, and then went on, "Oh, sure, you can still live with us, boy. You won't have to pay us board. You can work a bit when you come back from school and eke out things that way, but we just don't have the money to pay for a lot of expensive things. We're living hand to mouth now, barely making a do of it. So think it over, boy, think it over. I think, and your mother thinks,
It'd be a wonderful thing if you could be a doctor, but it would be an awful thing to be a poor doctor because you haven't got enough money to keep going. Mary Bond said, Alan, you know what happens to failed doctors, don't you? You know what happens to doctors who are struck off, don't you? Alan looked at her sourly and said, I only know what rumors I've been told to try to discourage me. I've been told that if a medical student fails or if a doctor is crossed off, he just becomes a hack traveler for some scruffy pharmaceutical firm. Well, what of it? He queried. I haven't failed yet. I haven't even started. And if I do fail, I still have to earn a living. And if I can earn a living as a medical salesman, then it will be a darn sight better living than slinging potatoes in a bag and weighing them up or counting pineapples or muck like that. Stop it, Alan. Stop it, said his mother. You're making fun of your father's trade, and it's your father who is keeping you now. Remember that. You show no respect at all. You're getting way above yourself. Why not come down to earth? And then she said, after a long, pregnant silence, Alan, Alan, why not take that job Uncle Bert offered you in the insurance office? It's a real steady job, and if you work hard at it, you might even be able to work your way up to be a claims adjuster. Think about it, Alan, will you? The boy morosely left the room. His parents silently looked at each other, and then there was the sound of his footsteps going down the wooden stairs behind the shop. There came the slamming of the street door and the sound of his feet on the sidewalk outside. Don't know what got hold of that boy, said Martin Bond. I don't know how we came to produce such a fellow. Ever since he could talk, he's been on and on, endlessly, monotonously, about becoming a doctor. Why the hell can't he settle down like other boys and do some decent job? That's what I want to know. Why the hell can't he do it? Eh? His wife silently went on with her task of darning the already much darned socks, and there were tears in her eyes as at last she looked up and said, Oh, I don't know, Martin. I sometimes think we're too hard on him. It's right, after all, to have an ambition. There's nothing so dreadful about being a doctor, is there? Martin snorted and replied heatedly, Well, I don't know about that. The good earth and the produce thereof is good enough for me. Never did hold with these boys mucking about with a woman's innards. Don't seem right to me. I'm going down to the shop. With that, he angrily jumped to his feet and stamped down the back stairs. Mary Bond threw down her darning and sat still, gazing out the window. Then at last she got up and went into the bedroom and got down on her knees by the side of the bed, praying for guidance and for strength. After many minutes she rose to her feet again, sniffing and saying to herself, Funny thing, all the parsons say about praying when one is in trouble, and I do just that. But I've never in my life had a prayer answered. I guess it's all superstition. That's what I think. Sniffling, she left her bedroom, and then wiping her eyes upon her apron, she started preparing supper. Alan walked gloomily along the sidewalk. Idly he kicked a can, which was in his way. By chance, or was it by chance? He kicked a bit hard, and the can flew up at an angle and made a tinny clank as it hit a metal plate. Alan looked round guiltily and prepared to run for it. Then he looked up at the metal plate. R. Thompson, M.D., he read. He went to the metal plate, the brass plate, with the incised black wax-filled figures, and rubbed it carelessly with his hands. For some time he just stood there, bowed in thought over the plate let into the wall. "What's the matter, old man?" asked a kindly voice, and a warm hand fell lightly to his shoulder. Alan jumped off the ground in fright and spun around to look up to the smiling face of a big doctor. "Oh, I'm so sorry, Dr. Thompson. I wasn't meaning to do anything wrong," the boy said in some confusion. The doctor laughed at him and said, "Well, well, what a face of misery. Have you taken on all the cares of the world, or what?" "Just about, I guess," replied Alan, in a tone of deep despondency. The doctor glanced quickly at his watch and then put an arm around the boy's shoulder. "Come on, lad, come inside. Let's talk about it. What have you done? Got a girl in trouble or something? Is her father after you? Come inside, let's see what we can do about it." The doctor gently led the hesitant boy through the gate, up the little path and into the surgery. "Mrs. Simmons," he called, going to the door, "how about rustling up some char for us? And have you got any of those sweet biscuits, or has that lazy husband of yours scoffed the lot?" From somewhere in the depths of the house, a muffled voice answered. The doctor went back into his surgery and said, "Okay, boy, get yourself composed, and we'll have a cup of tea together, and then we'll see what there is to be done." Mrs. Simmons soon appeared with a tray on which were two cups, a jug of milk, a basin of sugar, and the very best silver teapot, plus, of course, the inevitable silver jug of hot, hot water. She had thought long on the question of should she produce the best silver teapot or an ordinary china one, but then she thought, well, the doctor obviously had someone of great importance there, or he would not have called down like that. It wasn't surgery time or anything, not yet. She didn't even know what the doctor was doing at home at such a time. So, the best china and the best teapot and the best smile on her face as she entered the room. But then her jaw dropped. She thought there would be a lord at least there, or perhaps a lady, or perhaps one of the big businessmen at the Pool of London. But what she saw was a remarkably despondent-looking, underfed schoolboy. Well, she thought, he was a schoolboy in spite of the fact that he was getting on to be an old schoolboy. But she thought firmly it wasn't her business, so carefully she put down the tray in front of the doctor, bowed a little in her confusion, and went out, shutting the door behind her. The doctor poured out some tea, saying, "How do you like it, lad? Milk first? Or do you like it like me? Anything so long as it's wet and warm and fairly sweet?" Alan nodded dumbly. He did not know what to do. He did not know what to say. He was so engulfed in misery, so overcome with the thought that had he failed again? And then he caught himself. Again? Now what did he mean by that? He didn't know. There was something pressing at the back of his mind. something he ought to know? Or was it something he ought not to know? Bemused, he rubbed his head between his hands. What is it, lad? You are in a state, aren't you? Now just drink this tea, nibble a few of these sweet biscuits, and tell me, what's it all about? There's plenty of time. I'm supposed to be having a half day off, so let's make it a project to see what's wrong with you and what we can do for you. Poor Alan was not much accustomed to kindness, nor to consideration. He'd always been considered as the odd one in the family, the odd one in the district, referred to as that young son of a greengrocer who's got such grand ideas. Now the words of the kindly doctor got through to him, and he burst into bitter tears. Sobs racked his frame. The doctor looked at him with great concern and said, "All right, boy, all right. Have out your tears. There's nothing wrong in that. Get it out of your system. Go on. Weep all you want to. There's nothing wrong with it. Do you know? Even old Winnie Churchill shed tears. And if he can, you can, eh?" Shamefacedly, Alan mopped his face with his handkerchief. The doctor was impressed to notice how clean that handkerchief was, and as the boy held the handkerchief to his eyes, Dr. Thompson also noticed that his hands were clean, his nails were trim, and there was no dirt in the nails either. The boy went up several points in the doctor's estimation. "Here, lad, drink this," said the doctor, as he put out a cup of tea in front of Alan. "Stir it up well. There's a great dollop of sugar in it. The sugar will give you energy, you know. Come on, get with it." Alan drank the tea and nervously nibbled a sweet biscuit, and then the doctor filled up the cups again and moved beside the boy, saying, "If you feel like it, lad, get the load off your mind. It must be something dreadful. And a load shared is a load halved, you know." Alan sniffed and wiped away errant tears again, and then everything tumbled out of him. How, since the very first thing he had known, he had the strongest of strong impressions that he had come to be a doctor. How almost the first words he'd been able to string together in a sentence had been, "I be doctor." He told Dr. Thompson how all the time he had put aside boyish things, he'd studied, how instead of reading adventure stories and science fiction and all that, he had got technical books from the library, to the consternation of the woman librarian, who thought it most unhealthy for a young boy to want to know so much of anatomy. "But I couldn't help it, doctor. Really, I couldn't," said Alan in dismay. "It was something beyond me, something driving me on. I don't know what it is. I know that all the time I get the urge, an impossible urge, I've got to be a doctor, no matter what. And tonight, my parents have been at me, telling me I've got above myself and that I'm no good." He lapsed into silence again. The doctor put a hand on the boy's shoulder and softly said, "And what started the outburst tonight, lad?" Alan squirmed in his seat and said, "Doctor, you'll never believe it, but I'm top boy of the class, top boy of the grammar school. This has been the end of term, and the headmaster, Mr. Hale, has told me that I've been recommended for a special scholarship at St. Maggot's Preschool Med, and my parents, Well, then he nearly broke down again and twisted his handkerchief into knots between his fingers. Eh, lad, it was ever thus, said the doctor. Parents always think they can control the destiny of those whom they produce, sometimes as a result of an accident, too. But never mind, lad, let's see what we can find out. You said you were at grammar school. You said the headmaster, Mr. Hale. Well, I know Mr. Hale very well indeed. He's one of my patients. Okay, let's see what he can tell us. The doctor looked up his index and soon found the name of the headmaster and the telephone number, and then quickly he made a phone call. Good evening, Hale, said Dr. Thompson. Thompson here. I've got a young lad in front of me. He seems a very bright young lad, and he tells me that you've recommended him for a special scholarship. Good heavens, said the doctor in some amazement. Hale, I've forgotten to ask the boy's name. At the other end of the line, the headmaster chuckled and said, Oh, yes, I know him, Alan Bond, a very bright lad indeed, exceptionally bright. He's worked like a slave throughout his 4 years here, and I thought he was going to be a failure when he joined in the first case, but I was never more wrong. Yes, it's quite true. He's the top boy in the school, the highest marks we've ever had, the most progress the school has ever seen, but... And the headmaster's voice faded for a moment, and then he continued. I'm sorry for the boy. His parents, you know, they are the trouble. They've got that little greengrocer's shop down the street. They're making hard going of it. They're strapped for money. And I can't see how that boy is going to manage. I wish I could do something to help him. I've helped him to get a scholarship, but he needs more than that. Well, thanks a lot, Hale. I appreciate your remarks, said Dr. Thompson, putting down the phone and turning to Alan. Boy, he said, I had much the same sort of trouble as you've had. I had to fight every bloomin' inch of the way, scratch with tooth and nail, to make a do of it. Okay, I'm telling you what we're going to do. Let's go along now and see your parents. I told you it's my half day off, and what better way to spend what's left of it than helping some other poor devil who also is having a bad time. Come on, lad, stir your stumps. The doctor rose to his feet, and Alan got up as well. At the door, Dr. Thompson gave two rings and then said, Oh, Mrs. Simmons, I shall be out for a time. Just take any messages, will you? Down the road they strode, the big, tall doctor and the undernourished boy who was making a late approach to manhood. Down the street they went, and as they approached the shop, they saw the light was on. Through the window they could see Father Bond weighing out bags of produce. The doctor strode to the door, rapped sharply, and put his hands beside his face so he could peer in, free of reflections. Martin Bond looked up sourly and then shook his head in negation. He mouthed the words, closed, but then he saw his son there and he thought to himself, Oh, my God, what's the boy done now? What trouble has he brought us now? And then he hurried to the door and drew back the bolt. The doctor and Alan moved inside, and Martin Bond hastened to slide the bolt shut again. Good evening. So you're Martin Bond, eh? Said Dr. Thompson. Well, I'm Dr. Thompson, and I live down the street. You know, I've got my practice there. I've been talking to your boy, and he's a bright young lad, too. I think he deserves a chance. All right for you to talk, Doctor. You don't have to scrabble for money in a place like this. You're set up pretty good, I reckon. You get enough from your fees and from the friendly societies to keep you living high off the hog. I've got to dig in the ground. But anyway, what's the boy done now? He asked. The doctor turned to Alan and said, "You told me you got this special diploma. You told me you got a special letter from Mr. Hale, the headmaster. Will you slip upstairs and get them and bring them down for me?" Alan darted away and could be heard running up the wooden stairs. Dr. Thompson turned to the father and said, "Mr. Bond, you've got a bright boy there. He might even be a genius. I've been talking to his headmaster." Martin Bond turned on him in a fury. "What's this got to do with you? How do you come into it? You leading the boy into trouble or something?" he asked. For a moment, the doctor's face clouded with wrath, and then, controlling himself, with an effort, he said, "Every so often, Mr. Bond, somebody comes to this earth, perhaps with some carryover from a previous life. I don't know what it is, but people have strong impulses, very strong impressions. Well, they don't get it for nothing. Your son seems to be one of those. His headmaster was very emphatic that the boy was bright and that he was born to be a doctor. If you think I'm leading him astray, well, you think again. I'm trying to help him." Alan dashed into the shop again, just about breathless with the speed of running. Meekly, he held out to the doctor the diploma and the copy of the letter from the headmaster, together with the acceptance of the headmaster's recommendation from the dean of the pre-med school of St. Maggot's. Without a word, the doctor took the papers and read them from start to finish. There wasn't a sound except the rustling of papers as he turned over a page and put the red page on the bottom. Then, finished, he said, "Well, this convinces me. I think you ought to have your chance, Alan. We'll see what we can do." He stood for a few moments, wondering what was the best course to take, and then he turned to the father and said, "Why can't you, your wife and I, have a talk about this? The boy is brilliant. The boy definitely has a mission. Can I talk to you somewhere?" Martin turned sourly to Alan and said, "Well, you started all this. You brought all the trouble here. Get on with that weighing up, and I'll have the doctor talk to your mother and me." So saying, he led the way out of the shop and up the stairs, being very careful to close the stair door after him and calling up, "Mother, I'm bringing Dr. Thompson up. He wants to talk to us about Alan." Upstairs, Mary Bond hastened to the top of the staircase, muttering to herself, "Oh, heavens, oh, my God, what has that boy done now?" End of chapter 6.